Hi, and welcome once again to From the Center, a podcast by the Center for Western Studies. I'm Jack Val, on faculty at the Center for Western Studies, joined, as always, by my friend and colleague, the director for the Center for Western Studies, John Hodges. Sir, how are you?
I am fine. I am fine. I'm just looking forward to a couple of trips coming up. You know,
yeah,
we've got our annual trip to La Brie. I'm speaking this weekend at the La Brie conference. And then in a few weeks after that, we're going to be going to Europe.
Yes, the magisterial Europe trip.
That's right. That's right. We're looking forward to that, too. Although, we're very sad that you're not going to be able to join us this year.
Alas and alack.
Yeah.
I suppose my four previous journeys to Paris will just have to do.
For the time being. But also, I understand that you're going to have a little addition to your family, and that should be happening about the same time that we're in
Europe.
Yeah,
when you guys, either right before or right when you guys leave, our daughter should be born.
Isn't that exciting?
She'll be our first.
Very,
ever.
Very good.
And I am utterly calm and perfectly serene, and I'm not sure if that's a good thing or not, because I feel like I should be more stressed out than I am, but I feel pretty good about it all.
Oh, that's good. She's doing good, too. She's doing well.
Yeah.
Excellent.
I think she has more on her than I do, obviously, but I think she's doing pretty good.
I was going to say, well, I mean, you don't have to be there. She can take care of having the baby. You could go to us, with us to Europe, right?
Yeah, I'll run that by her. We'll see what happens.
It reminds me of a moment just before our son was born. He was born early in the morning on a Saturday, and at about 10 o'clock in the morning that morning, I was supposed to have conduct a dress rehearsal of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony.
Yeah.
And I told my wife, at, you know, just about an hour before delivery, listen, can you hurry this along? I've got a rehearsal coming up. She didn't think it was funny.
No. I don't think she did.
I don't think she still thinks it's funny now that I think about it. Oh, me. Oh, anyway, we're very excited for you. And, of course, we'll miss you on the trip. But there's some really great reasons why you won't be there. But actually, that leads us into the kind of discussion we want to have today.
Yeah.
We've had an interesting article we read about a woman who was making, kind of trying to make the case for being pro-life and pro-choice at the same time.
Yeah.
Which is an intriguing notion. Is that possible? That you could hold the best of both of those at the same time and make it work?
Yeah, this was, as usual, I was scouring Facebook for people who were wrong.
Yeah,
and instead, I stumbled upon a former friend and peer of mine who has moved away, so I haven't had much contact with them since. But they posted an article from an outlet called Upworthy, which I think considers itself a Christian outfit. I'm not sure if it's Christian or religious, but it definitely, this article at least, was styling itself as Christian-based.
Yeah, she certainly said she was a Christian.
And the friend who posted it said that this article basically summed up their position.
Uh-huh.
So I went to read it. And if you want to find it, it's at Upworthy, and it's something, I can't remember the title of it. It's like,
let's see, it is called, "It is possible to be morally pro-life and politically pro-choice at the same time."
There we go. So in the article, the lady who makes the argument is basically hanging her hat on two points, as far as I can tell. And I apologize to her if I'm about to butcher them, but I'm going to try my best to summarize the two points. The first one was, in essence, a very libertarian kind of argument that the government shouldn't have any say over what happens to our bodies anyway. Like, giving them that sort of authority is dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and what business does the government have in a private medical decision between two citizens? Or between a citizen and their doctor, or a husband and a wife and their doctor, and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, basically the charge was thrown at the people who, if you're pro-life, you're typically on the right. And so the charge was thrown at, you complain much about government overreach, and yet you're perfectly fine with governments getting in here,
right,
you know, this part. So
right,
if you really are against government overreach, you shouldn't want the government to be in there at all. which I'm giving my hand away a bit, but that's not an argument for keeping Roe v. Wade. But anyways, but that's the libertarian argument, sort of a, you know, the government shouldn't have a say in this thing.
It's the same kind of argument you hear about homosexual marriage, right? Mm-hmm. The government shouldn't be defining marriage for us anyway. It should be something that's defined by the church and so on.
Or smoking marijuana or gun rights. You know, that's all. The libertarian argument is consistent across the board in that way, that the government ought not to be involved in this stuff. That's more, that's better left on the private, personal level. So that's one argument. The other argument, I had a hard time summarizing, not because it was difficult, but because it, I felt like they were all the same, but there were different points. It was a kind of moral argument about if you really do want to limit abortion, if you really do want abortions to like become less and less, then you let abortion become legal. Because if it's illegal, it won't go away. It'll go underground where it's more dangerous and it can even become more prolific because nobody's keeping their eye on it. Meanwhile, when abortion, she got some statistics or something about when abortion became illegal, abortion rates dropped.
When it became legal, they dropped.
When it became legal, abortion rates dropped. Right. There's also stories of like women who were in situations where there was a miscarriage or there was going to be a miscarriage or there's some sort of medical complication that the laws of their state, which were heavily restrictive on abortion, weren't clear enough about whether this constituted a medical emergency or not. And so they were stuck in a very tough situation where they had to carry their baby around until it died, basically. They knew it was going to die, but they had to carry it around to die anyway because as long as the baby was technically alive or had a heartbeat, the doctors couldn't do anything. And so there's like having restrictions like that cause undue toil and legitimate suffering to the mother because they know their baby's going to die and now they have to carry it around until it dies and so on and so forth. There was a couple examples that she gave.
How horrible.
And how horrible that was. So there was a moral argument that keeping abortion legal allows it to be regulated and it allows for extreme situations to have an outlet in some way.
It does sound a lot like the kind of pro-marijuana argument too, doesn't it? It's a kind of consistent libertarian approach. Both of the things you just mentioned are kind of consistently libertarian. Just keep the government out of this, make things free, and then let people decide what they want to do and then sort of answer to their own gods.
Mm-hmm. So basically it was on those two things that it was interesting because it was an appeal to what I guess you could say are stereotypical right-wing arguments. You don't like the government overreach? Fine, keep abortion legal so government can't reach into, you know, the medical, you know, the exam room, the doctor. You care about abortions being less and less frequent, well, guess what? Making it legal is what makes them less and less and less.
Right.
It makes them go away and also helps keep mothers safe and so on and so forth. There also was, in the second argument, the usual charge about pro-lifers don't care enough about the mother. They only care enough about the baby.
Uh-huh.
And we need to provide for the mom and not just the baby.
And I go a step further and say the argument is that pro-lifers often don't care enough about the baby. That is, they want to see the baby born, but then after the baby is born, is he taken care of and looked after and so on? Single motherhood is very difficult, and the argument from the left is if you know, with all these non-aborted babies, you know, these living babies now that aren't wanted, what are you going to do about that? Are you going to, you know, just let them all, who cares? In a sense, you're saying, who cares what happens to them after they're born, as long as you don't kill them before
they're born. That's the, you're not pro-life, you're pro-birth.
Yeah, exactly.
Argument.
That's right. Well, I can see your points. I can see I've read through the article too, and I can see your two points. I think you're right about those. But I had a slightly different maybe take on where I found difficulty with the arguments there. That is, what she was saying, the author was saying things that I thought were appeals to the emotion, which are typical, of course, in an abortion debate. Both sides kind of appeal to emotion, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
But she certainly was appealing to emotions by our sympathies for the mother and for the horrors that certain mothers have gone through, and also I saw just a general assumption of a kind of enlightenment mindset that favors science over faith, mm-hmm. a division between faith and reason, or a division between fact and value, and an emphasis on science and fact without giving the same or equal or maybe even greater worth to what she claims is her faith. Mm-hmm. So those are pieces I'd like to talk about as we go through. You want to give us your take on those two, that libertarian kind of approach, those two-pronged libertarian approach?
Well, sure. I mean, I kind of gave it away a bit on the first one early on, but the argument that the government should, it was weird. It was like the context of this article that I figured out very quickly by searching links to other articles she mm-hmm. was citing for like the horrible stories that some yes. women have had to go yes. through. All of it was under the auspice of the Kavanaugh hearings that happened last
really?
Year.
Maybe.
Yeah, all of them were like, this was unfortunate, and it's neither here nor there because it really doesn't matter to the argument, but it was kind of unfortunate that these stories that were really human and gut-wrenching and stuff only kind of came out because there was a political thing that needed to happen.
Oh, yeah,
you know,
right.
kind of thing. It was really kind of, I felt like it stained the whole thing. It's like, it's one. It's probably going to, why stories like this or things like that probably only are going to preach to the choir, not really reach anyone else. Because as soon as you get to the, you know, after they tell their gut-wrenching story with the Kavanaugh hearings coming up, as soon as that happens,
yeah.
people turn their ears off. Because like, oh, I get it. You're just another shill for the Democrats or something like that.
Right.
But this was under the auspices of the Kavanaugh hearings coming up. And so there was a lot of fear and trepidation about if Kavanaugh gets on the Supreme Court, then they're going to have grounds to overturn Roe v. Wade.
Which
I don't know why they would think the protege of Anthony Kennedy would be that zealous, but whatever. if Amy Barrett got on there, maybe they would be more concerned. But anyway, that's the usual sort of, you know, kabuki theater that gets played about these things. That Roe v. Wade's going to be overturned if Gorsuch gets on there. Okay.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Now, if Ruth Bader Ginsburg goes down, which seems almost impossible in a way, but if she goes down and then we do replace it with like Amy Barrett or something like that, okay, then I could hear your argument making sense. But the point is that it was under the auspice of losing Roe v. Wade. And I don't understand how you can make, and she never, by the way, in the article, she never used the word libertarian. It's just this libertarian argument.
We're labeling it that way. That's fair.
I don't understand how you can make an argument about keeping out government overreach by defending a federal injunction in some way.
Good point.
Right?
Inherent contradiction.
The problem, you don't even have to be there, because I know for a fact there are libertarians who are like pro-choice, but they hate Roe v. Wade. Because... Uh-huh. Roe v. Wade, they say, the argument goes, you want a libertarian argument? Here we go. Roe v. Wade never should have happened because there's nothing in the Constitution that says anything about abortion or anything. All
right.
Nowhere.
Right.
As such, you're darn right. The government shouldn't have any reach in the doctor's office. That's why you should overturn Roe v. Wade and let the 10th Amendment kick in and let the states decide individually what the laws should be.
Mm-hmm.
So,
In some ways, let me just interject here. Mm-hmm. In some reason, I think that's why it is that the states have been making such noises lately. For example, New York has just passed a bill that will allow abortion up to the moment of birth.
Right.
And I think the reason for that is that they are concerned that Roe v. Wade might down the road be overturned and it would go back to the states, and they want to have their piece in place, their law in place. Virginia tried to do the same thing and lost just by a hair.
Right.
But they tried to do it.
As horrifying as those bills are and were, it's like, you know, yay for federalism, right? You know,
yeah,
like,
exactly.
So I don't, the whole like government overreach thing falls flat for me when it's about defending some sort of big government overreach. Like the Roe v. Wade is something that should never have happened. It should have been kicked back to the states anyway. So if you want to argue some sort of libertarian position about how the government shouldn't be involved anyway, then logically you can't.
Right.
You can't argue for Roe v. Wade. You'd have to get rid of it,
right.
And then it would be kicked back to the states. So that's one thing on the first point. The second thing I don't think I can summarize so succinctly, because it's a discussion we've had multiple times before, the Paris statement series that we did, this came up over and over and over again. And that is, what role does the government play in not just making laws that hem in things, but in legislating morality?
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
And so on the one hand, I'm like, I don't want babies aborted. And on the flip side, I don't want the government having that kind of power.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a part of me that says, there ought to be some kind of morality that protects the unborn. some sort of moral system that's legislated to protect the unborn, but I don't think it should be on the federal level. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think the federal government should have the power. If state governments and local governments, where the people have an even more direct input on what laws get put over them, I feel like that's a different argument. So, but I guess that's my two points on the first point, is that it's not actually really a libertarian argument, and even if it was, I'm not a libertarian, so so there.
Right. It's libertarian arguments like that that make me convinced more and more to be a conservative and not a libertarian, frankly. And I'll get into some of that when I talk about my concerns about it. But what about the second point? The second point was just that there's no doubt that there's been a reduction in a lowering of the number of abortions by year. Just to give you a statistic pretty quickly, I looked it up from a peak of about 1980, where we were aborted 1.6 million children in that year.
Jeez,
it's come down to maybe 600,000 or 700,000 now per year. So that's a significant drop. Okay,
that's
and it's like a slow. It hasn't been like up and down and up and down. It's been a very slow, gradual kind of decline every year. A percentage point or two, sometimes as many as 5% drop. In the number. The assertion is, anyway, that the cause of that drop is the fact that it's been legalized. And I find that a shaky ground.
Well, I mean, they could be, and this is what I thought of, they could be falling into the causation correlation fallacy.
Right.
That somehow just because two things coincide, they must have been caused. They must be
one causes the other.
intimately related.
Right.
I mean, part of me wanted me to look up statistics and see, are abortions dropping because legalization has made it easier and therefore somehow, and all the prenatal care or whatever the Planned Parenthood stuff is supposed to give, is that what caused it? Or are there other factors like the fact that birth rates have also dropped? So there's not a lot of nearly as many babies being born anyway.
There are several things that we could look at. The fact that the baby boomer generation was larger than the following generations means that they, of course, have more people in it. A higher population means a higher number of babies being conceived. So it's not unusual that a population that is generationally getting smaller would maybe have, and the window of, I think most of the statistics are about women between the ages of 15 and 44. That's about what they say, because that's sort of the baby bearing years, you see, as the baby boomers get out of that age group over the last 20, 30 years, 25 years, it's not surprising that then the numbers would go down. Another reason why they might go down is that birth control has become more effective. The pill itself maybe hasn't become more effective, but there are a lot of other kinds of birth control people have used that have become more sophisticated and more able to predict and maybe control when pregnancies occur. So that may be another reason. The other statistic I think ought to be considered is not just the decline since 1980, which, of course, is 7 years after the Roe v. Wade decision was made.
Right.
But how many abortions were there before Roe v. Wade? It turns out that some states had legalized abortion before Roe v. Wade, just like some states legalized homosexual marriage before the Obergefell decision in the Supreme Court. So there are statistics about legal and illegal abortions. The illegal ones are a little sketchy, because a lot of times they're not reported, right? Mm-hmm. But what they say is that in 1970, there were two... Let me see. In 1970, the figure was around 400,000 abortions a year. In 1980, it was 1.6 million. And, of course, what happened in between was legalization. Mm-hmm. So to say that legalization somehow reduces the number is to only look at the second half of the graph,
right,
and not the first half. There was now abortions were on the rise in the 60s before 1973, mm-hmm. with free love and the kind of hippie movement and all that stuff. Sexual promiscuity went up in the 60s from previous decades. And I think as a result of that, there were more pregnancies too, and they were being aborted, many of them. So But the numbers still were in 1968, something like 200,000, maybe 400,000 by 1970. But then after Roe v. Wade in 1980, we peak at 1.6 million.
Right. So it seems that if you look at the whole context of it, it's not, I mean, is it clear that Roe v. Wade had any kind of effect? I mean, if we say that, well, if you look and see before Roe v. Wade, it was even lower than it is today. And then after Roe v. Wade, within 7 years, it exploded to 1.6 million. Is that proof that Roe v. Wade actually caused more abortions, or is that just another causation correlation thing?
Well, I think it's not too far from the truth to say that because it's legalized, you'll see more of them.
Okay.
I don't think that's too hard to imagine. I think the reason that that statistic, that things have declined, is striking to us is because everyone assumes that if you legalize it, then there will be more of it, right? Mm-hmm. And yet, after 1980, it's declined. Right. So, I don't think, if they're going to say that the legalization makes it possible to reduce the number, then I think they have to also consider that after legalization, it went through the roof.
Right.
I think we have to compare this today's 600,000 or 700,000 with the 200,000 at the end of the 60s before Roe v. Wade.
Right. So this, I always, I don't know how to say this, but apologies to my mathematician friends out there and statistician friends out there, though I don't know who you are yet. people using statistics as data always bug me because data is not an interpretation.
Right.
Right. Data always has to be interpreted, which means, I don't know how else to put this. I feel like this is the wrong way to put this, but I'm not sure how else to put it. I feel like data is not evidence. All right. Data is not, it is not necessarily evidence of your argument. All right. You could say, well, look, it dropped after thing got legalized, but then someone could come right back around and say, wait a minute, there's more data you're not taking into account.
That's right.
So I'm not sure if that's the right way to put it. That's statistics are not evidence. I'm not sure what I'm trying to say. I'm trying to say that statistics don't interpret themselves.
That, right? That facts and values are separate things in that way, and that you still have to bring some kind of interpretation to a fact.
But not just fact and value, but that there's facts other than statistical data.
Good
right?
Point.
That, like, and so when people throw it around, I always hated that when I was teaching composition, that when they're trying to teach kids argumentation, it seemed like finding statistics and data, so to speak, was like the only way to argue.
Oh, I see.
And the idea of, like, knowing about causation correlation fallacies, or like making sure, well, there's more data, there's more evidence or proof, there's more to evidence and proof than just data and statistics, just seemed lost on people because it's so easy to just Google search something and not realize that, well, this one statistic is a thing, but there's another statistic that complicates it, and there may be a third one that complicates it further. So it's like, it's more complicated than just pulling out one statistic and throwing it there and saying, look what it proved, or something like that.
That's right. That's a very good point. Those are two, in fact, very good points.
As far as the rest of the second argument, aside from the statistic that'll go down, the examples she gave of, like, hard situations where abortion bans or abortion restrictions made it more difficult, which all of them, if you go to the article, she links to all of them, and she says you should read them, and you should read them. You should go check those out. All of them, I think she cited four, all of them seem to fall under medical emergency to me.
Uh-huh.
'Cause my position as pro-life is that abortion should be not allowed except in instances of medical emergency where the mother's life is in jeopardized, and or the baby is clearly and obviously not going to be viable or something like that. Like, it's going to die, mm-hmm. right? Or it's dead already, or it's going to die even before it's born. There was one story in there I'd like to talk to you about. It had to do with the baby would be born alive, but the way it was going to be born meant it would suffocate to death in about a few minutes after birth.
Oh, I see.
And so the question was, well, do you let it be born and then die agonizingly, or do you kill it before it even has a chance? Mm-hmm. That was another question. Mm-hmm. But the other ones just seem to be basic, like medical emergency. And like I said, my position was always that it should be illegal, except in cases of medical emergency, life of the mother, the viability of the baby, and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So I didn't feel like any of those things were talking to me. You know, like these were like that somehow these stories were going to change my mind, and they didn't.
Wow, yeah.
But then it made me think, who is she talking to with this article? And I feel like if she was talking to pro-life people, she has a very particular image of pro-life people. She kind of gave it away in the first paragraph where she tried to be fair by stating what each side's position was regarding the other. Uh-huh. But I couldn't help but feel that the pro-choice position felt like just a textbook talking point, you know, women should have rights over their own bodies. And the pro-life position was kind of a slightly stereotypical caricatured, you know, a fetus is an individual person. She made it specific to still call it a fetus, then put individual in quotation marks. And anyone who kills it is a bloodthirsty murderer. Oh, she used those words.
Oh, brother.
And so I'm not sure. Actually, I say I'm not sure who she's talking to. I think I know who she's talking to. And it's an image of like a pro-life movement or a pro-life position that believes abortion should be banned in all contexts, at all times, in all places. Even if you have like an ectopic pregnancy, I think it's what it's called, where it will kill you and it will kill the baby. You should never have an abortion, even in those instances or something like that. Or even the more extreme variety that, you know, if they're really killing babies, then I'm going to go take my, you know, gun and go out there and kill them before they can kill the babies.
Right.
It just seemed like she was talking to kind of a cliched, radicalized version of pro-life stuff that is not me and is not any of the pro-life people that I know and is not, I don't think, what the majority of the pro-life movement even is. I think if you talk to them, they would say like something like what I said, like, and they, except in the case of medical emergency. Even, I could tell that a lot of the stories she put up was taking their aim right squarely at the Catholic Church because they're very hardline on this, right? They're even hardline on the issue of birth control because they see it as an unnatural changing of natural body chemistry and stuff like that, and stepping into something that is not really your territory to step into, which is another discussion. The point is that they took their aim, set their sights on Catholicism, and I know for a fact that the Catholic Catechism has in it somewhere that in an instance where a situation arises in pregnancy where you have to choose between the baby and the mother because you don't have a choice, you have to choose one, then you always choose the mother. Like, that's in the catechism. That's part of their authoritative position. And so I feel like whoever she's talking to is some sort of, I don't want to say straw man because I know there are these crazy people out there, but it was definitely a extreme minority, you know, or something. I felt like a position can be made, a pro-life position that does provide for and care for moms in dangerous and desperate situations, that doesn't have to be pro-choice or be for Roe v. Wade. In other words, I was completely unconvinced.
Yeah.
And it wasn't because the stories weren't sad and like weren't sad or didn't move me. They did. It's just that I didn't see why you had to be pro-choice to fix them.
Right.
And so I felt like whatever argument she was trying to make, she wasn't making it at me. Like at me or at a typical pro-life person. She was making it at some kind of, I don't know, unthinking zealot or something like that.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good picture. It's not unusual that this would happen in the abortion. I mean, it's never happened before, right? That anybody would make a straw man of the other side's argument.
That doesn't happen. We're all very conscientious
debate.
In our, you know, a bunch of baby killers on one side and totalitarian patriarchal misogynist on the other.
That's right. That's right.
It's a great company volleyball game. It's just like, you see them when we all come together.
Well, I would like to kind of go through a few of the statements that she actually says in the literal statements, kind of comment on them, I think, partly because of the two things I was concerned about, the assumptions about fact-value dichotomy and the emotional appeals that she makes, I think are, in a sense, I'm actually talking about how to argue more than I'm talking about the abortion issue even, you know, because I think it needs to be clarified in people's minds just how to go about. Does it sound arrogant to say we have to teach people how to argue with each other?
No.
it always feels like I'm being a little, I don't mean to be arrogant. I just mean to say that I'm interested in the truth, and anybody that's interested in the truth is going to have to put aside some of the things, some of the tools they think they have in their toolbox actually don't lead toward the truth, you see?
Yes.
And I think when they're used, they actually muddy the waters rather than clarify them. So she says, for example, I personally believe life begins at conception, but that's my religious belief about when the soul becomes associated with the body, not a scientific fact. It tacitly assumes that science trumps belief. It assumes that the Enlightenment separation of fact and value just is the way things are.
Right.
My values are personal to me, my religion, my Christian beliefs, my belief about life beginning at conception and so on is in that category. And yet, I can't enforce that in any way meaningfully because it's not a scientific fact, as though scientific facts were only the only truth.
Also, as a sidebar, I'm not sure it's true that it's not a scientific fact that it's a human life or something like that. The pro-life movement today is really harps on the fact that science is more and more coming to their side that it is a human life.
Quite right.
Quotes one guy, but I feel like at the very least, the scientific question is debatable. All right.
I think you're right. I think we have become so much more sophisticated technologically to show the baby's heartbeat or the spinal column being formed at such an early age and all those things. I mean, there's a whole lot there that science has actually made it possible for us to see by way of ultrasound and so on that we didn't know before. And so the argument in the 70s that this is just a blob of tissue didn't seem so far-fetched. Now, when you see a baby in the womb at 4 weeks and the heart is just about to start beating, it's just beginning to beat, you can't deny that it looks just like a baby. There's no doubt about it. So that, I think science in that way has, and technology has made it possible for us to see more clearly just how human we are early on. Another quote of hers was, "I've heard too many stories about families who desperately wanted a baby and ended up having to make the rock and a hard place choice to abort because the alternative would have been a short, pain-filled life for their child," end quote. Mm-hmm. Desperately wanted, that's what she says, or pain-filled life. These are emotional appeals. Mm-hmm. They're appeals to the emotion. How can anybody not be sympathetic with those things?
Yeah.
Right? There's no doubt that anybody on either side of the issue wouldn't want anybody to go through the horrors of a pain-filled life for themselves or for their child, or I know personally desperately wanting to have a child and not being able to have one for so long. Right. So fortunately, God eventually brought us a child, but right. We thought we weren't going to be able to have any, and it was very sad, very sad. Right. However, we live in a fallen world. Right? Mm-hmm. We have to assume on the front end that life is full of suffering for mothers and for children in all sorts of different ways. And anyone who opposes the point that she's making has to be seen as insensitive and to the suffering of the parents and so on. But that's not a fair fight. There's loads of suffering that we have that we can't do much about and that we ought to try and overcome, you know, to alleviate. Mm-hmm. But we also, if we're going to talk about being Christian, we have to admit that the one God himself who made life is involved with even these sufferings. Mm-hmm. And that to assume that we have the option to end life just because of the suffering or assumed suffering of a mother or child implies that the life and the situation came about accidentally. It didn't. Mm. And so if God has allowed suffering in your life, no one wants to visit that suffering on you, but if somehow God has allowed it, it may be for reasons that we don't understand, and the ends don't always, we can't claim the ends to justify the means. To take the suffering away from us may actually, because we think that it would be better for everybody, is kind of taking God's work into our hands and fixing it.
See, I've heard that argument before, and I agree with it, like, on a pure, like, theological basis of, like, suffering doesn't, like, nullify God's purposes, and suffering doesn't mean that a life's not worth living, right. So on and so forth. Suffering is not necessarily the evil that our highly decadent, highly technologically advanced, kind of wussified society gives to it, right? I agree with that. On a practical, down-to-earth level, people often take that idea and twisted into saying that, well, this is why, you know, if I can give the most horrible straw man-y version of it, I guess. This is why Christianity left us in the Dark Ages or something like that. Because rather than trying to make life better here, it just says, well, suffering is of God. So, you know, just let it go and it doesn't matter. And it's like trying to articulate how we ought to alleviate suffering as much as we can, as often as we can, because suffering is a product of the fall, and the fall is not good,
right.
And it is redemptive to try and alleviate it.
Right.
We have to somehow simultaneously do that and recognize when it's out of our hands, or when, like, it's something that is truly there's a judgment we can't make about a suffering, whether like it devalues a life or something like that, or whether is this suffering really going to make a life worth living? This is the Down syndrome argument, mm-hmm. all right? Mm-hmm. People who have children with Down syndrome, you know, they were told they should abort the baby because they'll have a low quality of life, and then their babies grow up and they become, you know, some of them, not all of them, but a bunch of them become pro-life activists and advocates of like, hey, I like my life,
yeah.
okay? I know right. that I'm, you know, I've got struggles and stuff, but you know what? It's worth it to be alive. You know, so in other words, you get these people who when they go, they are the ones who have to partake of the suffering, yet some reason they feel like it's worth it. Hmm. And so my point being is for our listeners out there, this is a very like nuanced kind of thing. Because on the one hand, we ought to alleviate suffering, and yet at the same time, we're not God. And so we can't really, like, for a I don't even know how to put it, but the Down syndrome thing is the one I was thinking of the most.
Sure, that can see why.
We would say, well, we could kill them to alleviate their suffering they're going to have in life, and yet the ones that actually live love their life.
Better to ask the ones who actually have to go through the suffering if they are, would have preferred not to be alive. But my point is a little more maybe, like you say, nuanced than that even. I'm not speaking so much about trying to discern between sufferings. Mm-hmm. I'm only trying to discern where the limits are and that I have in alleviating the suffering. Mm-hmm. Because if I think that I'm going to be suffering or actually am suffering with this birth, the trauma of the birth or the aftermath of the birth, the life that we'll have, can I go so far as to take the life of my child in order to alleviate that? My point is not Christians should just stoically take suffering, you know.
Yeah.
That's the Hindu model, mind you. That's the Hindu that says you were born into this caste, you were born into this life, and you have to deal with the karma of past lives, and you can't do anything about it. And even to do something about it is actually going to make your next life worse and so on. That's not the Christian way at all. We stand against the effects of the fall in every possible way. But the one way that we can't stand against the effects of the fall, as it were, is to break the law in order to accomplish what we think is better. And I think that's what the question is here. Many of this, the paragraphs that she writes for us here don't specifically say this, but they imply that the child is not necessarily a life. And so you can take that life if certain circumstances are allowed, right. You see, allow it. And then, of course, you want to make the circumstances as vibrantly emotionally appealing as possible.
Right.
And in doing so, you get people to swallow the idea that you can take a life. But but that begs the question, that in the literal logical sense of the word, begging the question, not asks the question, but it assumes in its premises its conclusion. It assumes if the question on the table is it murder to take the life of this child in any circumstance? If that's the question on the table, then to assume on the front end that it's not murder under these circumstances is to assume the conclusion, you see. Uh-huh. That's begging the question. I'm doing this just for our listeners' sake to know what begging the question means. I hear people say that all the time. Well, that begs the question that blah, blah, blah. And what they mean is that leads us to the question of such and such. And they're not thinking in logical terms at all. But that's what this is doing. And so I think... Again, I'll say I'm not interested in keeping anybody from alleviating suffering. Suffering is the result of the fall. Suffering is something that we need to stand against. That's why, for example, I think it's okay for us to have drugs, painkiller drugs, for women in labor, for example. Right. Labor turns out to be part of the fall. Remember how he said,
right.
You're going to have pain in childbirth.
Right.
Well, we want to stand against that to any degree we can. But the limits of standing against suffering are going to have to be the limits that God has given us in other moral areas. And so, for example, if I'm suffering in poverty, it's not okay for me to murder the millionaire that lives next door and take his money to alleviate my suffering, because mm-hmm. murder is actually outside the bounds of human.
Right. That's what I was thinking in my mind. To kind of wrap all these things together or tie them all together. If you use emotionally charged language, then it's easy to equivocate you know, cutting out cancer and curing a disease with cutting out a baby and
absolutely
curing
right.
a disease. Suddenly
exactly
you create an equivocation.
That
right. might not be there. It's one thing to say, of course, we want to alleviate suffering, but if it means murdering a child, I feel like there's a short story about that. I can't remember. If it was Ursula K. Le Guin or somebody who wrote a short story about a whole town that lives, and my literary friends are probably going to kill me because I can't remember who this person is. But I can't
just
remember.
Spur of the moment memory.
Spur
loss,
of the moment memory. There was a short story about a whole town that lives in just paradisal wonderment, and it's just beautiful and wonderful. But the protagonist or somebody finds out that the reason they can do that is because they keep some child locked up somewhere and they have to torture it constantly.
Oh my. Yeah.
So that they can have the paradisal side of things. And the question is, like, is that moral, you know? And it's kind of, I mean, I'm sure the story has other aspects to it, but just as a flash in the pan moment, it's a similar kind of thing. It's like, well, we can cause this good by cutting out cancer. Awesome. Well, we can cause this good by chopping up the baby. Well, that feels like that's different.
Right.
It feels like that, at the very least, you could say that feels like it's different. But emotionally charged language can allow you to equivocate, you know, a baby with a tumor. You know,
that's right.
She doesn't in the
that's
article,
right.
but she equates a baby with a problem that's on the same level as like a horrible disease or some sort of dire medical condition.
And the argument is that if there are too many circumstances that make suffering so intense that nobody wants to have to live with that, then somehow it's justified to take the child. Here's another example of that. She says, I've heard too many stories of mothers having to endure long, drawn-out, potentially dangerous miscarriages and being forced to carry a dead body inside of them because abortion restrictions gave them no other choice, end quote. Well, you mentioned this a few minutes ago.
Yeah, and the story she mentioned didn't really say they carried a dead body. It was more like the child was going to miscarry.
Oh,
it wasn't exactly dead.
Huh. I'm not sure I got that from the story.
Anyway, not to say she's lying, but I might have misread the story.
Well, obviously, yeah, I mean, it doesn't take too much peeling back the onion here to say that if the baby is already dead, then the activity is not an abortion any longer, right? To remove a dead baby from a womb is not to kill the dead baby. That's clearly a thing. But to say long, drawn-out, potentially dangerous miscarriages, you know, I don't want to get too much involved with the horrors of miscarriage. People,
no.
Bless them. My mother lost three, okay? Mm. I have one brother, and I would have had five.
Right.
So it breaks my heart even to talk about it. And it's very, very hard for women in any situation. We always run to try and think about this logically seems to say, I don't care about the feelings and the experiences of people who've gone through these horrors. That couldn't be further from my heart. But the idea of bringing up too many, all these stories of personal experiences and sufferings and anecdotal evidence and so on, is very difficult to prove any kind of principle by. I think I said that right. By which to prove principles. Another place she says, quote, too many stories of families who were staunchly anti-abortion until they found themselves in circumstances they could have imagined. To believe that abortion is always wrong and be banned at every particular stage. In other words, I was anti-abortion altogether, hard line, and then my daughter got pregnant, and suddenly I changed my mind, or my, you know, whatever like that. I started seeing a personal experience that made me change my mind.
And remember, being pro-life is banning abortion at all times and all paces and all circumstances again.
Right.
I don't know who she's talking to, but it's not to us.
No. Isn't to put a finer point on it, I think I understand the need for abortions in the cases of the danger to the mother. And I think the statistics are that those cases, plus rape and incest cases, all together account for 1.5% of the abortions that are done in the country.
Yeah, I've heard of that too.
So that to build your pro-abortion case on that statistic is very weak read. Isn't the same argument though given for homosexual marriage. This idea that I used to be anti something, but now my daughter came out of the closet, and now I'm pro homosexual marriage. Well, what kind of principle is that? When the situation becomes a personal thing, why then do you give up your principles? Shouldn't it be better to have your principles and hold to them, even if it means you have to suffer for it?
I mean, it's arguable you didn't even have the principle in the first place.
Good point.
Probably just a position you held. But when circumstances, I think it was, I mean, I'm sure many people have said this, but Oswald Chambers said something about how, circumstances will demonstrate your true character. Like where you really stand on things come out when the pressure is on.
Right. That's right.
And so if you were in a situation where you say, oh, yeah, I'm anti this or pro that, and then a circumstances comes up where you completely flipped, and the truth was is that you probably were never anti or pro that. You only gave lip service to it. But when it actually came down to put your foot down somewhere or to stand somewhere or to make a decision somewhere, you went the completely other way. Well, then you probably were not. If you weren't completely the other way, you at the very least weren't really standing anywhere.
Yes, that's right. And also it's common to say that it's easy to hold to a principle when it doesn't actually affect you.
Yes.
Right. It's just easier to do that. In fact, sadly, we do that all too often. Another quote here. Most people, this one concerned me probably more than any, but it really has very little to do with abortion. But listen to this. Quote, most people's anti-abortion views, mine included, are based on their religious beliefs, and I don't believe that anyone's religion should be the basis for the laws in our country. Well, we talked about that idea a minute ago, right? But I want to go a little further. And then she says, in parentheses, for the record, any Christian who wants biblical teachings to influence U.S. law, yet cries, Sharia is coming, when they see a Muslim legislator, is a hypocrite. Mm-hmm. End quote. Well, the Judeo-Christian beliefs are the basis for our country. Sorry. If you want to compare them to Sharia law or Hindu law or something like that, they are the Judeo-Christian beliefs simply are the belief. That's why it's not okay for you to be killed by your father for not wearing the right clothing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
right. Or for leaving the faith, or be genitally mutilated, any of those things.
She says she doesn't believe that. You know, my biblical faith should inform our laws. And part of me wants to say, too late.
Like, exactly.
It's way too late. That's another one of those, I think of what you would say, that's another one of those enlightenment things, this weird notion that somehow this system we have of the law we have and the cultures we have and sort of the norms we have just sort of popped, fully formed out of the mind of Immanuel Kant or something like that, or out of the founding
right.
fathers,
right.
and isn't based on hundreds, if not thousands of years of a highly religious, moral culture before it.
Exactly.
Is erroneous. I didn't catch that because I was focusing too much on the abortion thing, but now
sure.
to bring it up, it's ridiculous to say that. I don't think my biblical beliefs should inform law at all. And I'm like, well, in America, you're just a little too late. You're too late for that.
It's madness. It says that you don't have any idea of what the history of ideas really is all about, history of ideas. To compare Christian beliefs with Sharia law shows you really don't hold to either religion, it seems to me. Mm-hmm. If the two can be equal in your mind, and then you can say, well, neither one of them should influence laws, haven't bought into either one of them.
Right, it's a secular pluralist kind of position,
right.
and it
That's
wants
right.
to view the law as some kind of supposed to be neutral ground, and religions are these odd fanatical things that influence it one way or another, but the law must stay pure. And the idea that the law was actually built on an entire religious and moral culture right out of it is somehow lost.
Well, there simply is no way that she could hold to the very values that she holds to if it weren't for even the plurality, the desire for plurality and freedom of conscience and so on, is itself part and parcel of the whole Judeo-Christian mindset.
Right.
So it's foolishness, that's all. Another quote. While I don't think that that means women should abort inconvenient pregnancies, I also acknowledge that trying to force a woman to grow and deliver a baby that she may not have chosen to conceive isn't something the government should be in the business of doing. So what this sort of pops back to our question about whether the government should be involved in this decision making. But what I'd like to ask her is, she what's the difference between inconvenient pregnancies, in quotes, and, quote, a baby that she may not have chosen to conceive? Aren't those the same thing? She's saying, I don't think that women should abort inconvenient pregnancies, and at the same time, I don't think that women should be forced to carry what she calls a baby that she may not have chosen to conceive.
Right.
So what's the difference?
I think I agree with you. There's an inconsistency there. I want to feel like she's, again, to use our favorite word, tacitly assuming the convenience one is merely, oh, I just don't want a child right now, while the other one, she probably is trying to paint it in the colors of rape. She doesn't use the word, but I could feel like whenever, like, anyone...
I would think that would be an inconvenient pregnancy.
That would be, yeah, but that would also be inconvenient. But the point is, I feel like she's trying to make a distinction between people who abort just because they're just selfish and lazy and just don't want to... they're not in desperate straits, they haven't been raped, they have money, they have opportunity, they have plenty of ability to do it, they just don't want to, right? There's like, she's like, well, I'm against that. But I'm surprised why she doesn't just say the word, like... out of rape or something like that. If you're saying about it, because when she just says it, a birth you don't choose or child you don't choose, then it's open to what you're saying. Well, isn't not choosing it the same thing as an inconvenient pregnancy?
Yeah, so, that's what it sounds like to me. But let's get to the government question.
Mm-hmm.
Anytime anybody mentions the word government and force in the same sentence, it's going to feel oppressive and intrusive and overbearing, and nobody wants that. But do we think that the government is being overbearing when it insists that the thief or the rapist or the murderer be stopped and go to jail for what he's done? No. We agree that those things need to be opposed. So this argument begs the question again. That is, it assumes that it's okay to abort while it's attempting to prove that it's okay to abort. If we started saying, quote, while I don't think people should steal from each other, I acknowledge that trying to force somebody to stop stealing when it's inconvenient for the thief shouldn't be something the government should be in the business of doing. See how it begs the question? If we all agree that thievery is wrong, so we don't have a problem with saying the government should step in and stop thieves or punish thieves if they've already done the work. But what we're trying to do is decide whether it's okay to abort the child. And in doing so, we say, it's okay. I don't think the government should step in and stop somebody from aborting the child.
Right.
But that's the question on the table.
Right. Should the government step in to abort the child? Well, no, but because I've already presupposed that it shouldn't.
That it's not supposed to be done. So shouldn't we be legislating... We shouldn't be legislating Christian morality, she says. And yet we would all say that pesky sixth commandment, the sixth commandment not to murder, that pesky commandment actually does need to be have the government step in and say no to. So it's all a question of whether or not this is actually immoral to do. And if it is immoral to do, there's no problem with the government stepping in and saying don't do it, at least if it's on that kind of level. Now, there are plenty of things that are immoral that we don't ask the government to step in on, like gossip, for example. I think gossip is immoral, but we don't want the government telling us when gossip happens. So I can see some area in there where there are things that we agree as Christians are immoral, but we don't think the government should have a part of. So the libertarian argument is not trashed by what I'm saying here, it seems to me, right? The libertarian argument that says that the government should just let people choose for themselves and answer to God basically on their own. But her argument is that I don't want the government forcing at all, and yet she would be very happy to say, yes, the government should force, step in and stop certain things.
Right.
And we're just saying, I'm just arguing that this is one of those things that the government needs to step in and stop. It's really more like murder than it is like gossip, if you see what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Then she says, as a person of faith, my role is not to judge or vilify, but to love and support women who are facing difficult choices. The rest of it, the hard questions, the unclear rights and wrongs, the spiritual lives of those babies, I comfortably leave in God's hands. Well,
I hate arguments like that. They drive me absolutely batty that people separate the idea of discernment from love.
Yeah, exactly.
That love is this just some kind of uncritical, open-armed thing that doesn't make choices or has no wisdom attached to it, or
exactly.
Or doesn't seek the best for you. Love and discernment ought not to be separated. from each other.
That's right.
All right, and
that's
this notion right. that it's not my... But she doesn't turn it in terms of discernment and having wisdom. She turns it in terms of judging and vilifying or right. something like that, which, right. okay, yeah, it's not our place to vilify, except actual villains like the devil. But, I mean, right. it's, who vilify themselves. But, okay, it's not our place to vilify, but vilification and having, like, wise discernment about tricky moral issues and theological issues is perfectly in keeping with love.
The same God that loves us enough to die for us gave us the law.
Yes.
Right? So we don't have to see a discontinuity between those two things. Yeah, and I think certainly we should love and support women facing difficult choices. There's no problem with that at all, but shouldn't we also love and support the only one in the equation who doesn't have anybody to speak for him? So even if you do want to say love is this open-armed, open, embracing, caring for, looking after, you know, no judgment or vilifying or anything like that, okay, but why is it only the woman that's getting this treatment and not the baby?
Right.
Who speaks for the baby? That's what I want to know. Right. Who speaks for the baby? We're time and again, we're told that we need to look out for the underdog, to care for the ones that can't speak for themselves, you know, the poor, the downtrodden, the jailed, the whole sheep and goats parable is mm-hmm. about how we're supposed to be feeding and caring for and visiting in prison and all these things of the people who are marginalized and separated. Mm. It's the argument that people are using to encourage people to break down the walls and allow immigration willy-nilly without any... Because right. these are people that are in need. They're the marginalized. They're trying to escape the difficulties of their... They're refugees from Central America or Syria or someplace, right? That's the argument. And it's not a bad argument completely, okay? I'm not knocking it completely. But if you buy that argument, why isn't it applied to the baby?
Yeah. It is interesting to start your article by saying that you believe that a fetus is a human life and is a baby and all that. But then when it comes to who we show love and compassion for, the baby is nowhere to be found.
Not talked about.
And it is in some ways, you're not pro-life, your pro-birth argument is a slander and a lie, because there's plenty of pro-life people who work tirelessly to help women who are in desperate straits
Absolutely.
Before and after. So it's a slander and a lie. But it has some bite to it, because there are some people who their rhetoric and their actions do line up with this, I just take this position, and there's no sort of outside, there's nothing else about like actually helping the mom or something like that. Likewise, there's something on the other side, the pro-choice side, that it just assumes, no matter how much it wants to say, we respect the human life, and we believe it's human life, and we may even say religiously we believe it's a baby, but when it comes time to show compassion and care, the baby is completely cut out, pardon the pun, from the discussion,
right?
It's completely cut out, as though, when actually rubber meets the road, speaking of your principles cashing out in some way when a hard time comes out, suddenly the baby isn't really a person anymore or
yes.
a life or anything worthy of giving love and compassion towards. It seems that both sides, in some way, fairly or unfairly, could be accused of not caring for both people
right.
in the discussion.
I think you're right about that. I agree with you about that. And so we have, whatever the position we take, we have to be willing to consider the opposite of that. That is, even if we want to say a hard-line pro-life stance, what about the caring for the mother? I'm all for that, okay? I'm all for that. For the same reason that I would say just what I said about looking after the baby. But I say this last word prophetically, maybe, okay, just so that people can hear what I think Jesus actually taught. And it's a dangerous and scary thing. He actually, in that parable, talks about whatsoever you did to the least of these, you did to me. Mm-hmm. And that is a very dangerous position to be in. I don't want to stand before the Lord and hear him say that to me and point at the babies that I aborted. I think he cares about them as much as he cares about the mothers and about you and me and about the world. So be prepared to hear him say that. And I think that means take seriously the argument that you can't leave the baby out of your equation when you're considering what to do in your very difficult and very anxiety-filled and emotionally supercharged moment.
Yeah. I think it is one of the I believe it's one of the sickening tragedies of our society, and another reason why I've said before, usually online, that politics poisons everything. Yeah. Our politics poisons everything by turning it into these reductionistic zero-sum games. You would think that when Jesus said, whatever you've done to the least of these done to me, that the least of these would apply to everybody that is marginalized, forgotten, cast out, has no voice. It would apply to everybody.
Right.
The unborn and the mothers and the refugees and the mothers whose children were murdered by illegal immigrants and the illegal immigrants whose children died on the way there or something, you think would apply across the board. And yet for some reason, because of political positions, we want to A, use the least of these argument, but then B, be very selective about which the least of these actually count.
Right.
And it's, if I sound like I've got contempt in my voice, which I'm not sure if I do or not, because sometimes I feel like I sound very vanilla, but there is contempt there, let me put it that way, because I find this wholly disgusting, how we just, it's like we want to be selective about who actually counts as the victim or who actually counts as the person to be helped. And for some reason, our political situation for the last who knows how many decades has set itself up that if you even think about any kind of way, nuanced or otherwise, to help this one group of the least of these, suddenly you're the enemy and you're depraved and evil.
Right.
If I stepped into certain right-wing circles, Christian or otherwise, and tried to posit, well, you know, we need to do something for, you know, illegal immigrants that are just like women and children. And so I'm just trying, we need to do something for them. I could be completely branded as like a sellout to the country and want to destroy the Republic. And I don't love Jesus or something like that.
Right.
There are people out there that are probably Democratic or progressive, but they could step into an environment and say, you know, unborn babies are people too, and they're marginalized and they don't have a voice. Shouldn't we be defending them? They could be completely vilified and castigated because somehow they're a tool of the patriarchy or, you know, authoritarianism.
Well, it's a way to control women's bodies. That's literally what I hear.
So it's frustrating how we've let our political false dichotomies force all of us into a position where we suddenly act like we can be selective about the least of these. And this is another instance where if you're a Christian and you're selective about the least of these, then I say to you again, your gospel is not radical enough.
Right.
It's not radical enough. You're supposed to care for all of these marginalized, voiceless people, born, unborn, white, black, brown, fellow citizen or foreigner, whatever. You're supposed to care about all of them together all at once. And it's so easy to just be selective and then ramrod some simple thing through rather than do the hard, difficult, nuanced, moral work of trying to care for them all.
Yeah.
Like care for them all in some way.
Yeah, and I think we do the same thing with virtues. Because we like a particular virtue, we stand on it and then dismiss some others. And the argument for that virtue is the argument for the virtue you're dismissing. Mm. So it's impossible to stand there if you don't actually hold the other one too. For example, we pick and choose virtues like love, and we want to love and support the women and their difficulties and so on, because we're called to Christian love. That's why we're supposed to do that, right? But at the same time, we ignore the call to not murder. So how can you do those? You can't take one and not the other.
Right.
The right will do the opposite and say, we know that it's wrong to murder, right? And yet, then that mean, what does that mean? I have to turn off the faucet of caring for the widow or the mother who is in difficult straits? Yeah. No. Why does it have to be an either-or thing like that?
I know. Love and wisdom are both virtues. And
right.
love without wisdom can become just as reckless and destructive as any hate.
Sure.
But wisdom without love can become just as cold and apathetic and uncaring as any hate in
so
some
true.
Way or any kind of malice. They need each other, and it's a shame how, for some dumb reason, we have, for whatever reason, whether it's been decades or centuries in the making, have slowly wedged all these things apart and then want to act like we're doing you know, God's work.
It doesn't work that way. Let me say one more thing before I let it fade from my mind, and that is I've complained about this author that she tacitly assumes a kind of non-Christian position that separates faith from fact from value and separates Christian virtue from the sort of larger God's economy that includes the government, not excludes it, and so on. And frankly, I think she tacitly assumes that the child in the womb is not a child in certain circumstances. She doesn't say that, okay? She never says it.
No.
But I think she kind of assumes that because of the circumstances of all these sufferings that allow her to then consider aborting the child or allowing other people to consider aborting the child. Well, I want to go on record as saying I don't think that I am immune to that either. What I mean is I assume on the front end that the child is a child. See, and all that I've been talking about actually stems from that assumption. So my Christian position, my faith position, she and I debate about what the faith position should be. That's not my point. She's thinking the faith position is to be against abortion, and then she can go on to be pro-choice in the sort of public square. Mm-hmm. I'm saying that my faith position is pro-life, okay? But I'm not debating, in a sense, pro-life, pro-choice. I'm just debating whether or not your Christian faith, whatever that is, should trump the science and the government that you see going on about you, around you, you mm-hmm. see. If somebody comes along and says, I believe that the baby is a baby from conception, but I don't see any proof of that in science, so I can't insist on it. I say just the opposite. I say I don't see any other way right off the bat to not put my faith into practice and say God made that, knitted that child together in the womb at conception, and as far as I'm concerned, it's a child from that point on, right? And if science, in a sense, if science doesn't agree with me, I still want to hold to that. However, as we've just said, science is actually coming around to that position.
Right.
All I'm trying to do is establish that our faith positions are significant and ground our virtue. They ground our understanding of what's right and wrong to do. And science and statistics and laws are all more superficial things than that.
Right. It's bizarre to think so, but it is true that for all the wonders it gives and all the fascinating things it can do, it's dubious to hang your hat on science, because science always changes.
Right.
I mean, you want to say like, well, you know, I believe it this way, but science is this other way, so I guess I'll keep it to myself. Like you said, back in the 70s, it was just a lump of tissue.
Right.
It wasn't a baby or a human being at all. Then our science and technology advances, and suddenly we're like, oops, looks like we were wrong. Because that's just how it works. So I guess that's the statistic thing, too, is that statistics can change, or there's other facts and variables. Science can change. It's not the solid resting ground that people want to give it. It's good, but it's not adequate.
Well, and like we said earlier, science actually doesn't offer a kind of value. Statistics or in science don't offer values. They simply record what's there, right? The facts. The idea that this thing actually caused that thing is another question. Or even, should I be doing that? The question of oughtness and shouldness comes not from science, but from belief. Mm. Well, I guess we better wrap up.
Probably.
I hope we've done her justice. If there are questions along the way, this is one of those topics that I think really should be discussed and debated, not debated, but discussed in a safe space where people who know their emotions are going to be in their circumstances and their sufferings are going to be taken seriously. And so if there are people out there that would like to talk about this, we would love to talk with you and understand we are not here to judge and condemn anybody for anything. We're trying to come up with Christian principles to live by because we think God is glorified there and it protects everyone involved. But that doesn't mean that we don't sympathize with anybody going through the horrors mm-hmm. of unwanted pregnancies or rapes and incest or any of these other things that are going on.
Right. Well, on that note, any recommendations of any kind?
I'd like to recommend something. It doesn't really have anything to do with what we were talking about. I haven't seen the film yet, but I'm interested in seeing it. It's a film by Peter Jackson about the First World War. It's a film that goes back to archives and takes a lot of the film that was shot in the war, in the trenches, in the circumstances, and then he has colorized it. So it's not black and white anymore, like it would be then. But also, he has found lip readers to read the lips of the people in the films talking and figured out what they're saying and then dubbed over them what they were talking about so we can hear it.
Oh, wow.
It's really kind of cool. So it brings it all to life in ways that the original archival footage couldn't. Also, he's gone through, painstakingly looked at various papers and orders and things that they were reading from and so on at the time, and so that he knows what they're saying,
Wow.
And he can tell you. And it's such a traumatic time, you know, the beginning of the 20th century, and that First World War was really the beginning of the end of Western civilization, in a sense. Mm-hmm. In that the First World War kind of leads into the Second with an interval between, and the upheaval and the loss of life in Europe,
right? And the destruction of institutions.
Yes, yes, and the devaluation of life. In a sense, that's tied into our abortion discussion because partly is the devaluation of potential life of life, the gas that was used, the machine guns that were used,
yeah.
And eventually the annihilation of the genocide of the Nazi regime and so on. It's a terrible loss of the dignity of life.
Yeah.
But I think it would be a worthy movie to watch, and I'm looking forward to seeing it. So I suggest that other people see it, too. The title of it is They Shall Never Grow Old.
Okay.
And it has to do with those who died.
Okay.
You see.
I guess recommendation-wise, in the same vein, you made me think of it. One of my favorite online shows and series I mentioned before is called Extra Credits. And they usually talk about video games and stuff and analyze it, and it's very fun. But they have another project called Extra History, where they do series on historical events, and they're really fun to listen to and to watch. And they have several on World War I, including there's one that's all about the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand, which, if you know all the ins and outs of how that happened, it almost makes you feel like, in some weird way, World War I was meant to be. Because just like in some sort of mysterious sense, it was meant to be. Because how he wound up getting assassinated is just mind-blowing, how that happened. There's a small series on all the inner machinations leading up to World War I and all the sort of missed opportunities and miscues that if just one thing had happened differently, maybe it wouldn't have happened. Yet again, it just looks like it all leads towards it. And there's one about the Christmas miracle, about in the trenches one Christmas day in the first year or whatever, people decided to lay down their arms and not fight each other on Christmas Day. One of my favorite parts, the way the video works is it's animated, but it has a guy like narrating it, almost like he's giving a lecture. But he has fun with it. One of my favorite parts was that there were like German soldiers who saw like Bavarian soldiers like praying or whatever. And the German soldiers asked their immediate officer, who was a corporal, if they could go join them. And the corporal, like angry, was like, "What? Have you no pride? No German pride? We don't go out there and do that." And he said, and the narrator was like, "The soldiers were a little put down by this, but Corporal Hitler was always a little off-putting.
Whoa.
Yeah, he was always a little weird." So it was like stuff like
the
that.
Little corporal,
like,
they called
Yeah, little nuggets and things
Goodness.
Like that. So they have any one of their World War I series, whether it's the video about Archduke Ferdinand's assassination or the video about the Christmas miracle or their short series about how it led up to it. If you wanted to watch those things and then watch this Peter Jackson movie, I think you would probably get a big dose of like that. A time that was so tumultuous and so significant, yet it doesn't get nearly as much attention in our popular imagination as you
That's
think it
true.
Would.
That's true.
That's all the time we have for today. This has been From the Center, and we'll see you next time.
See you next time.